Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We're excited to welcome to the show the amazing recording artist Luke K as he talks about his new video, Dance With You, and his fast-rising career. We're also joined by our social media expert, Patrick Charles, talking about iRadio. What is it, and when does it get into your hands? Human resources consultant Sharon Armstrong stops in to talk about properly handling job interviews when you're asked invasive questions, and we also spend time with a great band from the southern U.S., Surfer Blood. We top things off with a smooth remix from Kesha, Crazy Kids.
Capture your need for sound.
The long-rumored so-called iRadio is on its way, or is it? Apple has been working behind the scenes with some of the world's biggest record labels and artists to get it going, but so far, we're still not sure if it's even going to happen. Joining us on the show is one of our teammates from The Kelly Alexander Show, a social media expert, Patrick Charles. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. How you doing?
Good, good. So this week we're talking about iRadio. What is iRadio, you know, essentially trying to be?
Well, what they're trying to be is, I don't know how familiar you are with Pandora and Spotify and services like that, but the thing is, Apple wants to get into streaming because they see where the trend is going. Actually, they're starting to lose revenue through iTunes because of streaming. We talked last week about the fact that so many people are starting to go towards it, and Apple is seeing that people are buying less iTunes because of it.
Wow. Okay, so this is definitely changing the market, if you will.
Completely.
Okay. So what's holding iRadio up, do you think?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, we've been hearing about this. The rumors have been flying around for years, actually. And what seems to be happening is they're having a tough time negotiating how much they're going to pay the record labels for the songs that they stream. Because you see what happened the first time around when Apple made all their deals with everybody and started selling songs for 99 cents each, the industry was in a state where they were terrified and didn't know what to do, and they wanted somebody to save them. And that's what Apple came in and did. And now, of course, they feel like, hey, I think we could have got more money than 99 cents a song. Yeah. So now they're trying to work out a better deal. They're playing hardball with Apple.
Okay. But I know that Apple doesn't really usually play hardball with anyone. They didn't even want to give Oprah Winfrey iPads. So I'm sure they're not. Are they nervous? Like Apple? Like, I don't know. Like, I know she was upset.
I think Apple is a bit nervous, but so far the rumor is that they've got Universal on their side, Universal Records, which is the biggest record company, and they've got Elton John, Enrique Iglesias, Calvin Harris. They've got them on their side. But what is supposed to be the sticking point right now are groups like Sony, who has Beyonce, Daft Punk, Mark Anthony, yeah, you name it. They've got a lot of big artists. Sony so far has been stonewalling them. That's what they're saying.
Okay. So do you think like it's going to be a long drawn out process to come up with whatever this money is going to be or whatever details they need to figure out?
Yeah, I think it will be, because the problem is the way streaming works is that it's totally different from royalties that get paid for actual downloads. Mm-hmm. So what's happening now is there's sort of an agreement with Pandora and Spotify and those companies to pay, I think it's about 12 cents per 100 spins of a song. It's kind of convoluted the way they do it, but they make complicated math so nobody understands exactly how much they're getting paid. But that's basically it. It's 12 cents per 100 spins. So Apple is, of course, trying to negotiate something probably smaller since they're a massive company.
And in the grand scheme of things, why is Apple moving in this direction then?
Well, they really have to, because they see the writing on the wall. You know, like we said a minute ago, that the iTunes have been going down over the last couple of years. The average person, you would think, buys a lot of music, but they actually don't. The average iTunes user spends about $40 a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's it. Because people are buying single songs for 99 cents. Now, these streaming services are about, they're $5 or $10 a month usually for like a full package to be able to stream through your phone and through your computer. So that's automatically $120 a year,
mm-hmm.
which is much better than $40 a year.
Right.
So you can see why they want to go this way.
And I want to get back to iTunes in just a sec, but I want to sort of finish our thought process on this. In the grand scheme, how is this good for music fans or bad for music fans?
Well, I think it's great. I mean, it's taken a while for people to sort of catch catch on to streaming. But I think it's fantastic because, I mean, rather than downloading stuff to your computer, you get to listen to and sample everything that you want to hear. I mean, I spend most of the day on Tuesday going through the new releases, and I listen to, you know, entire albums because, you know, in the old days, you'd run out and you'd buy a CD, you'd go home and hear the couple of tracks that you liked and then be disappointed. Or you would think the group was something that they actually weren't, and you'd be disappointed 100% with the album. So this is a cool way to listen to as much as you like. And if you're really a big music fan, I don't know why you wouldn't go for streaming.
Okay. Now, is this going to be the same thing for an American as it is for a Canadian or someone from Europe? Like, is it all going to work the same way, basically?
I think it will, basically. There's always music that's sort of restricted depending on regions. There's always stuff that comes out in Europe faster, or comes out in Canada slower, that sort of thing. But it'll be essentially the same thing, because one thing that Apple is able to do normally is make the experience the same for everybody all over the world. I mean, like, you know, the prices are all pretty similar for computers and iPads and phones and that kind of thing. And for iTunes Music, I think it's going to be the same thing. That's if it's called iRadio, by the way. We don't know. That's what everybody's been calling it, though.
Okay. Now, when it comes to, we talked about music consumers, what about the artists, bands, solo artists? Is it going to be good for them in the long run as well?
Well, I think it is, because, again, I mean, it gives people the opportunity to listen to things without feeling as though, you know, they've spent so much money to buy a CD. I mean, CD prices got so ridiculous. You know, albums used to be $7.99. When you were buying records, they were $6.99 and $7.99. And then all of a sudden, people started to, you know, crank up the prices of CDs. And a lot of times you'll hear a song you like, and if it's been out for a little while, the CD might be like $27. So the idea of streaming it and getting to listen to something you really like, I think that's fantastic.
And how is this quote-unquote iRadio going to differ from the other streaming services that you mentioned?
Well, I think the big thing is Apple has access to, or they will have access to once the deals are all done, probably more music catalogs than anybody else. I mean, Apple spent so much time, remember, iTunes is 10 years old already. They've spent so much time negotiating with labels, and they've worked really hard at getting as many people as possible on board. I mean, you're amazed sometimes when you look at somebody, an independent artist who gets something out, and they say, oh, you can buy my single on iTunes. And it's pretty amazing. You could never find somebody like that, you know, someone who's completely unknown on one of the big services like Pandora or Spotify.
Now, I wanted to ask you as well, is this going to make money for iTunes or for Apple? Like, is it going to work?
Yeah, I think it will. I think people will, you know, if Apple does it, I think people will jump on board, because that's the big thing. I mean, right now their shares are down a little bit because everybody's saying, oh, you know, the iPhone is done, and they haven't come out with anything mind-blowing. I think that the next big thing for Apple to do would be streaming radio, because if they do it, everybody's going to pay attention. Because as much as we talk about Spotify and Pandora, most people still go, well, what is that exactly? Because those are big companies in the US and in Europe. But I mean, in Canada, we haven't heard that much about them, and a lot of people don't really know. But if Apple does it, that will make everybody pay attention.
Can I talk to you a little bit, again, it's an offshoot of all of this, iTunes, because I was actually just hanging out with a friend of mine the other day. We were talking, you know, audio and all that kind of stuff, and then he mentioned that he cannot stand the new iTunes. Do you agree? And why does he
yeah,
not like
you know
it?
What?
Like, why do they
do
not like it?
I do. I think it's terrible. The interface is a mess. But I was never crazy about the way it worked and the way it looked to begin with. It kind of looks cool. iTunes kind of looks cool when you open it up, especially when you open up the store and you see the new releases at the top and they're all sort of flipping by. Mm-hmm. But actually going through it and using it and uploading stuff to your, not uploading, but loading stuff into your phone, I think is a big pain.
Right.
So that's another reason to get away from it.
Are they going
and get
to
into streaming.
Revamp that at all, or just focus on this, you know, again, iRadio?
Well, they just revamped it recently. This iTunes 10 that we have now only came out not that long ago, maybe, I don't know, 6 months. So I think they're going to stick with this design. I think it's pretty bad. A lot of people think it's bad, uh-huh. But it's one of those things, after it sits there, you'll just get used to it.
Okay. And do you think that people that like iTunes will, you know, move to iRadio and stay with that? Like, because I know people don't like change is basically the bottom line. Will they embrace this?
I think they will, because I think that it'll be a lot easier. I mean, just think of the idea of you know, hitting the app on your phone and just automatically playing music and not thinking that, oh, I didn't put that album in my phone. Oh, I wanted to get that CD. This way, I mean, you're paying per month and all of a sudden you have whatever you want that's new or even that's old, and you just go and play it automatically. And also remember that since iTunes has been around for over 10 years, like I said, they have probably the biggest collection of credit card numbers anywhere on the internet.
Wow.
Bigger than Amazon, bigger than eBay. I mean, think of how many people have iTunes accounts.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of a no-brainer if it's just like, click here and sign up for iRadio. It's like, yeah, I'll try it.
Right.
And I think a lot of people will.
And I wanted to speak to you as well about the catalog. Will they have the B-sides? Will they have the remixes? Like, or is it just going to be mainstream, whether it's country, pop, you know, or metal? Like, will you find those other things?
No, I think you'll definitely find those other things, because I think that that's where people's interests lie more than ever.
Okay.
And you'll notice a lot of groups releasing, you know, one song or four song EPs. I think that they'll have to go into that sort of slightly grayer area of music catalogs, because I think that a lot of people will only become interested if it has that.
And do you think the newer artists, if you will, are going to jump on the bandwagon? Is it going to be the established artists that are leading the way?
No, I think the established artists are the ones that are usually sort of dragging everybody down.
Right.
Because they remember the old days of selling, you know, 10 million albums, 30 million albums. And I think that those guys are still holding out, thinking that people will go and download their songs. Because, like I said, the royalty rate is higher for a downloaded track than it is for a streamed track.
Okay.
So I think that, you know, the older artists, I mean, the U2s and the Bon Jovis of the world, will always be hoping that they'll be able to sell a lot of records, because they like to hang their hat on a number still.
Right. And again, this is a bit of an offshoot, but just because you brought up Bon Jovi, when they released their album, whatever it was, 2 months ago or a month ago, I know they spent all this time, because I remember seeing John Bon Jovi on the Katy Couric show talking
right.
about the album cover and how it's like 3D or something.
Oh, really?
What the hell was that? Like, why do they, like, I was just, it was sort of weird to see John Bon Jovi trying to explain that, like, it's this big album cover and you can, and you, and I guess also it was interactive.
Yeah.
And I was just like, wow, that seemed kind of clunky to me, but he seemed all about it.
Yeah, because again, see, that's one of those things. I mean, he's a guy from the old days of, you know, they've sold over 30 million records. And I think that for him, that still matters. So he figures, you know, a physical stunt like this, something that you can actually hold in your hand, something tangible, he's hoping will get people into a record store or wherever people buy CDs these days, and get them interested in actually owning a copy of the album. But, you know, the bands should really sort of get over it, because, you know, the recording industry, the Recording Industry Association that logs how many albums are sold, they've actually added in streams that people have played into how many copies an album has sold, quote unquote. Do you get what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
They used to count up like, say, 500,000 sold albums would be gold, 1 million would be platinum, right?
Right, right, right.
But now what they're starting to do is they're counting how many times songs get streamed, and they're actually using that as sales.
Wow, okay, that's
so cool. It's all changing.
It's very much changing. Well, Patrick, thank you so much. I really appreciate you always keeping us up to date with all of this stuff.
I love it.
Awesome. That's Patrick Charles, again, member of the Kelly Alexander Show team, and you can find him on Twitter at GetPatrick.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
I'm very happy to welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show a very talented artist, musician, and dancer whose star is on the rise. Luke Kay, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, Kelly.
So here's the thing. I want to give my audience an idea about who you are if they don't know who you are yet, especially because we have a lot of people that are listening online from overseas. So can you give us a bit of a background on yourself? How did you get your start in music, and was becoming an artist a childhood dream?
Well, I pretty much grew up in a musical family. My dad was a choir director. My sister sings, my brother plays instruments. So I pretty much grew up around music. So it was only right for me to follow that path. So I took a path of songwriting. You know, I wrote a few songs for a lot of artists in the industry that people are familiar with today. And I decided to branch out and come out as an artist. Because I actually singing and performing is actually my biggest passion. So here I am today, two singles later, and going hard.
So can you tell us what drew you to the R&B pop dance world? Like, what drew you to that specific type of music?
Well, I mean, I grew up on, Michael Jackson, to Boyz II Men, to Marvin Gaye, to Brian McKnight. I mean, to be honest, I'm a lover of all styles of music, but I definitely grew up on R&B and, of course, pop music as well. So I did listen to also the Backstreet Boys, the NSYNC, the Michael Jackson. So, you know, that's pretty much what I fell in love with. And growing up, I started to explore different styles, you know, like pop rock, you know, or even country, believe it or not. So I mean, I'm a lover of music as an overall.
Can you explain to us how your songwriting career took off? Because you mentioned before that you've done some songs for other artists. I know, for example, Carl Wolf is one. Can you explain like how you even got a song in his hands, for example?
Well, believe it or not, I actually met Carl Wolf a few years ago before I moved to LA, and we kind of stayed in touch. And one day, I wrote him on MSN, and I was like, hey, go check out my MySpace. I have a few songs that I wrote on there. You know, let me know what you think. And ever since, he fell in love with my music, and we started to work together. And then from that, I started to collaborate with different producers, such as Grammy producer Will Baker, and also Dark Child as well. So it was really a networking thing. So from word to mouth, It kind of pretty much, I mean, the word got around, and that's how I ended up writing for a lot of different artists in the industry.
How was it like, or what was it like working with Dark Child? Because, you know, for anyone who's sort of a fan of R&B pop, I guess, like, you know, we all know that he's worked with Janet, he's worked with Destiny's Child, like the list goes on and on and on. So what was it like to work with him, and what did you take away from that experience?
Well, I mean, I took a lot. I mean, Dark Child, it's pretty much a production team. So it goes, of course, Rodney created it, but there's many other great producers that are there. And honestly, by working with those producers, I mean, I learned a lot. It expanded my knowledge in music. So it was definitely a great experience. Definitely learned a lot.
Who else would you like to collaborate with in the future?
Believe it or not, Taylor Swift, maybe Beyonce, even Rihanna as well, too. That would be interesting.
Joining us on the show is artist Luke K. Make sure to check out his website, lukemusic.com. And when you go to the site, you can find all of his social media, Twitter and Facebook and all that sort of good stuff. So again, lukemusic.com. What inspires you when it comes to writing music? What do you pull from?
Well, I get inspired by everything around me. It could be a friend's situation, or it could be a personal situation as well. I mean, anything that I feel that people are going to relate to, or a story that people need to hear, I'll focus on that and try to make it as general as possible so that when people hear it, they can actually see themselves in the song, or if they're going through a certain situation, maybe that they can actually relate. So I usually go for topics that would reach the maximum crowd.
Now, do you write the lyrics first, or do you want to get sort of the melody and the beats down? Like, how does that work for you?
Well, when I started writing, I used to write the lyrics first and then put the melody, and then I kind of changed to like making the melody first and then write the lyrics. So I mean, it, either way, I mean, sometimes if the lyrics come to me first, then I'll write them down and then try to arrange a melody to it. But sometimes, most of the time these days, I put down the melody and then try to put words into it.
And what's your favorite way to write the melody? Does it come out of your head, or are you like tinkering around on the piano or the guitar?
Out of my head, believe it or not. I mean, I know a lot of people, they'll get on the piano and play some melodies. But me, I have so many melodies in my head that, I mean, I don't even have to have music. I can create melodies and then have somebody, you know, make an instrumental to my melody.
Now, if I can call you this for the moment, I would say you are obviously a Canadian artist. Do you think that you're going to need to leave Canada in order to really spread your wings, I guess, kind of like Justin Bieber did?
Eventually, I mean, most likely, but of course, I'll definitely always have a home in Canada, because, you know, Canada is my true home. But for sure, I'll probably have to get a second home elsewhere just to be available and to be able to, like, you know, go to interviews or shows, and it'll facilitate everything, the whole process.
What place do you think that would be? Are you like a New York guy or Los Angeles guy?
Well, I grew up in Florida, so it would most likely either be in Florida, or it could be LA, because I also lived in LA. I love both of those places. So It most likely probably would be either, you know, Miami or LA, but it definitely has to be somewhere where the sun shines, because I think I got enough snow in Canada. So,
what do you think about other Canadian artists, Luque? Like, I know, for example, you've worked with Victoria Duffield before. Obviously, we spoke about Carl Wolf. What do you think, or how do you feel about the Canadian pop scene, if I can call it that? Because, you know, I think everyone always associates Canada on some level, apart from Justin Bieber, with like rock bands. But obviously, we have a really healthy pop scene, I would say, especially in the last 5 years.
I'll definitely say that the pop culture has definitely gotten a lot bigger over the years. Like you said, a lot of people associate Canada with rock bands, but I think these days, you know, we have a lot of artists that are coming out with some great pop, you know, songs such as Victoria Duffield or Jordan, Sean Desmond, Danny Fernandez, and even Carl Wolf. I definitely think that the pop culture is definitely getting bigger and bigger.
What advice would you give to someone who is, you know, growing up right now and wants to do what you do? Because obviously you have learned a lot probably in a short amount of time. What would be your biggest piece of advice for someone who wants to get to where you are?
I would say there's four D's that I go, four words with the letter D that I go by, which is to have a desire, dedication, determination, and a discipline. And with those four, if those four are applied religiously, I think you have a very strong chance of making it. And perseverance is very, very, very important as well.
Can you talk to me about social media for a moment? You know, obviously it's become such a huge thing in like the last 4 years or so, maybe five now. What's your thoughts on Facebook and Twitter, you know, and so on? Like, which one's your favorite? And has it shown to you or proved to you to be a useful marketing tool to get new fans?
I definitely appreciate the social media, because unlike back in the days, with these two, especially Facebook and Twitter, the fans get to get close to the artist, so they can get to see, you know, how our everyday life goes, or what kind of things that we eat, or what kind of activities that we do, and they can kind of get to know us on a personal level without necessarily meeting us in person. So I definitely think it's something that is important for the fans to get to know the artist and not see just a photo and a persona, but get to know the person.
Your new video just came out for Dance With You. Can you talk to us about the process of putting that music video together? And, you know, I've seen it and it's awesome. And you look like you're having so much fun. Do you really enjoy doing music videos? And do you think they're still really important to do? Because I know, like, even for example, right now, if we take a look at MTV, they don't play nearly the amount of music videos that they used to play.
Yes, I definitely think it's very important. And I'm really happy that, you know, YouTube and Vevo exist, because it's very important. Especially for me, it's very important for people to get a visual of what the song is about. I mean, me, when I write a song, I visualize at the same time. And whenever we sit down to create the music video, I wanna give people what it is that I had in my head, and something that they'll enjoy. And of course, because I'm a dancer, I like to include dancing in there as well.
You know, we've talked about Dance With You, also I'm In Love With Music, the two songs that a lot of us know about. What's up next for you? Like, are we going to get an album? And what can we expect to see from you, I guess, in the next, like, you know, 8 months to a year?
Well, definitely, for sure, an album will be coming out, but we don't have any dates. But so far, we're on the second single, and we're trying to even see if we can push that across the border. So we're in talks with companies around the world, and see if we can make that happen. And hopefully it takes off really, really, really in a very big way, so that by the third single, we can release an album.
And what do you want to say to people who are listening right now, again, who are just, you know, maybe hearing about you for the first time? What, like, one word or what phrase would you say best describes Luque?
Music lover.
Very good. I love that. Luque, thank you so much for joining us on the show. We really, really appreciate it.
The pleasure's mine.
That's Luque. Make sure to check out his website for all of his social media and all of his information. Plus, you can check out his new video, Dance With You. Again, luquemusic.com.
Hey, what's up? It's your boy Luque, and you're hanging out with the Kelly Alexander Show.com.
Hunting can be a long and painful process. It's something that does take time, effort, and lots of luck to find and land that dream job. Sharon Armstrong has 20 years of experience as a human resources consultant, trainer, and career counselor. She's joining us today to talk about getting through that interview process and some of the things you might want to keep an eye out for. Sharon, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. Happy to be here with you.
Sharon, you know, job interviews can often be really nerve-wracking. And generally speaking, I guess, what are potential employers looking to you assess in an interview?
That's a good question. I think mostly they want to know that you have the appropriate targeted skills to do the job they have advertised. They're looking for a link between your skills and their needs. So you need to do as much preparation as you can to learn about the company, about the position, and then what you've done in the past, it'll really resonate with them.
So it is important, and I think people really need to get this in their head, that you can't just go in there willy-nilly. Like, you really need to have your information down pat.
Please don't do that, because you are defeating the purpose. You're really sabotaging yourself. So you want to make sure that you have done as much preparation for that interview as you can. You want to really be able to sell yourself effectively. And in order to do that, you need to know as much about that company. But you don't want to lose track of the fact, Kelly, that it's a two-way street. So the organization is determining if you're a good fit, but you're also determining if the job's a match for your skills and interests.
Now, what are some of the most common mistakes that you've seen potential employees say or do during a job interview?
That is a great question. I think many people do not spend the time in the preparation, so they maybe do not look at that website of the company sufficiently to be able to talk about it. They haven't done their due diligence regarding investigating the recruiters. They haven't practiced some common interview questions. They're not prepared to ask questions. They maybe haven't brought extra copies of their resume or their reference list. They didn't get a good night's sleep. They didn't dress appropriately. And they forgot to be polite and professional as soon as they walk in the door, because that's really when it's game on.
Okay. And I'm assuming that, you know, oftentimes if it's a younger person and this is, you know, only their first real time out or maybe second or third time out at doing this, that they might go in there and sort of act in an inferior type of, I guess, just the way they're carrying themselves. And they can't really act that way. Not that they should come over or come across overconfident, but like you said, they really need to realize that they are bringing something to the table as well and not to be afraid to ask questions of the company.
I think that's right. You want to be in a state of mind where you are proud of your accomplishments and you can talk about what you've done. You don't want to embellish, but you want to make sure that you have a clear idea of the value you can add. So we're not talking about arrogance, we're talking about confidence. And there's a big difference. But that is your time to shine. That is your time to talk about what it is you've done that, again, will most resonate with that listener so that they know that you have the skills and abilities to kind of hit the ground running. And if you are a young job seeker, feel good about what you've done regardless of the environment. If you've done customer service, if you've done problem solving, anything from a fast food place to maybe even projects you've done in school as a team. You know, feel confident about what you've done and what your role was.
How much of an impact does social media play in terms of hiring someone for a job?
Well, it does in many, many ways. I mean, I think you want to be very active on LinkedIn. You want to have a good professional profile. You want to be very careful with your privacy settings on Facebook. You want to be careful of how you brand yourself if you're on Twitter. You want to use all the social media to look for openings. So it's becoming a bigger and bigger important part of a job search, I think.
Can we actually talk for a second about, you know, your private life versus your corporate life with regards to Facebook and Twitter? Because I'm understanding that now some job interviews are asking, you know, potential employees to give up their Facebook password so they can troll around their Facebook page.
Well, there's a real danger there. I mean, I will tell you a funny definition that I heard, the difference between LinkedIn and Facebook. LinkedIn is a professional business cocktail party, and Facebook is a kegger, a beer kegger.
Right.
So you want to kind of keep that in mind. You really want to separate your personal life from your business life. You have no control over what an employer might try to check. You certainly don't have to share that information, but know that people might get onto a page where you've posted pictures, and you want to make sure that, especially at a time, crucial time in your own business development when you are trying to get opportunities and you want to put your best face forward, you want to make sure that there are certain parts of your life that remain very private.
And when it comes to, you know, maybe a potential employer asking for your Facebook password or, you know, requesting you to be a friend on Facebook or, you know, wanting to see this, that, and something else from your Twitter account, do you have the right to say no and sort of be actually concerned about it? Because I feel like there is a definite line that's being crossed if they're asking to check out your photos from your Facebook page.
I think there's a line that's being crossed, too. And I think that, you know, the applicant is under no obligation to give that. But if you're in the face-to-face situation, it might be a little uncomfortable for the job applicant when asked that. I have a colleague who, whenever she was asked a question that was a little inappropriate, she would say to the interviewer, "That was a trick question, wasn't it?" and kind of smile. I thought it was a hilarious way to kind of diffuse the moment.
Wow, that is good.
Isn't that great?
That is great.
And I think, you know, it also kind of talks about the legal considerations. An employer is only supposed to focus on the applicant's ability to do the job. That's the most important factor in any hiring decision. So employers are barred from considering different things in the hiring process, you know, in the U.S. under the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
Will it actually hurt someone's chances of not getting the job if they choose not to answer some of these questions, which, again, we've determined can be invasive?
You know, Kelly, it could, but on the other hand, they might not want to work there.
Right.
I mean, quite honestly, it might be a sign of the type of culture they'd be joining. So, I mean, an employer has to be aware of the type of impression they're leaving when they're asking these type of questions. And I think they, you know, it really is an employer's market these days, and that's a little unfortunate in that people who are interviewing get a little bit of kind of this power trip going. It has to be done respectfully, adult to adult.
Joining us on the show is human resources consultant Sharon Armstrong. Make sure to check out her website, SharonArmstrongAndAssociates.com. Now, some recruiters obviously are passing this invasive line, and not just sort of Facebook and Twitter. I've also read that they are asking personal questions like, you know, have you been divorced before? How many relationships have you been in? Because apparently this is some sort of gauge to see how stable you are, you know, outside the office. How do you, I guess, handle these invasive questions and know where to draw the line?
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right. One of the classes that I teach is behavioral interviewing to managers, and we have a whole legal section. Again, because the only thing they should concentrate on is the ability to do the job. So there needs to be a direct link between their questions and what, in fact, that'll tell them in terms of your ability to do that job. So there are a lot of unlawful questions that are still out and about. You know, where are you from? Are you divorced? How many kids do you have? Do you plan on having kids? Totally inappropriate. So again, in the moment, the applicant has to make a decision as to whether to answer that or not. If it doesn't matter to them, they might answer it. If it's appalling to them, they don't have to answer it. It's really a bit of a low risk for an employer because it's rare that they would get in trouble for doing that. But it really does point to a lack of knowledge or education on the part of the employer in terms of what's appropriate in the workplace.
What is your take on potential employees being asked, you know, for these types of things, like whether it's the Facebook passwords or, you know, again, invasive personal questions? Like, do you think there's any place for it, or they really have, like, it's like above and beyond what they're doing?
I'll be honest, I think it's almost the next frontier because there's so much of this information on all of us out there that it's not unusual for employers to try to get as much information as they can. You know, it's very hard to get references these days because people are so litigious. So, you know, only companies generally will just give name, rank, and serial number, right? They'll just confirm salary and give you very little info. So on the part of the employer, it's hard for them to get information. Again, I think the only information they should be trying to get is that information that will let them know whether the person has the skills and abilities needed to do that particular job. So we're talking about technical skills and interpersonal skills just as they relate to doing whatever that company needs done in that role.
Is there any kind of background check or questions, I guess, that a potential employee, you know, could or should be asking a company before going in for an interview? Because like we talked about off the top, you know, you need to find out if this is a good fit for you as well.
You know, a lot of my career clients will actually try to do their research around colleagues and friends of colleagues who might know that culture of that company. And I think that's really a good step for any applicant to take. When they're doing their research on that website, another piece of research is to find anyone who might know someone there to get a sense of the culture, how they operate, how they treat individuals. I think that's all information that goes into the decision-making for an individual to determine if that's a good environment for them to be successful.
What's your biggest piece of advice to a candidate going after their dream job? Because again, or a job that they really just sort of covet or want, because I think when you have something that you want, sometimes it's really hard for you to stay objective.
Yeah, I agree. I think that you want to really treat it as one of the most important research projects you've ever done. You want to find out all you can, and then you want to really turn the mirror on yourself so that you are able to really identify some key accomplishments that you've had in your past that you can share. And you want to be able to share those in a very concise, yet comprehensive way. So, you know, you think about what employers want generally. They want someone who will solve their problems. They want someone who has a history of cutting costs or being innovative or increasing productivity or motivating others or identifying problems or saving time. Think about the things you've done that you're most proud of, either in school or where you've worked, and how you can translate that skill and provide value to that potential employer.
Is there a difference as to how an interview should be handled if you are, you know, new to the job market or if you've been doing this for 25 years? Like, do you handle yourself differently or is it all the same sort of ballgame?
That's a great question. I think the most important thing in any interview is to listen. And that's the, you know, and nature gave us two ears and one mouth that we may use it proportionately.
Mm-hmm.
It really is true in an interview as the interviewee, because what you're trying to do is to listen very, very carefully to what the interviewer is trying to get from you and then give the answer and support it with an example. And I think no matter what stage of your career you're in, whether you have 20 years of experience or you're just an entry level, you have experience to talk about. You might have good relevant coursework to talk about. You might have done some internships. You might have done some summer jobs. You might have done some informational interviews. You might have learned things on your own. Those are all very valid and important behaviors that employers would need to know.
Sharon, now you've written some books. Can you tell us about them and also where, you know, we can get our hands on them?
Well, thank you, Kelly. It's always a privilege and an honor for an author to be able to give a two-second talk about their books. I've written four books, three business books, which would probably be of most interest, on two topics. One, my last book is called The Essential Performance Review Handbook, available on Amazon, all about the performance appraisal process from both sides of the desk. The book before that is called The Essential Human Resources Handbook. The Essential Human Resources Handbook, which again is for small organizations that might not have the HR feature in their office, but want to make sure they're doing things with best practices to engage employees and create a great environment.
Fantastic. And people can get these where?
Both of them are available on Amazon.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Well, Sharon, thank you so much for your time today. I really think that you've just given us some great, you know, advice and input about how to handle ourselves out in the job market, especially, you know, in this day and age.
It was a pleasure, Kelly. Thanks, and good luck to all the listeners in their job seeking.
Awesome. That is human resources consultant Sharon Armstrong. Again, make sure to check her out on her website, SharonArmstrongAndAssociates.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
We're very excited to welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show Surfer Blood, specifically group member JP. JP, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So happy to have you on. I wanted to talk to you about the name of Surfer Blood. If people don't know where that came from, can you explain where the group name, the band name came from? Because it's kind of funky and cool.
Well, our drummer has sort of a twisted way with words that's really it's really endearing. Him and me were driving on a road trip one day, and he's an avid surfer, and he had all this surfer stuff with him, and I was kind of making fun of him for it, and he went on this whole rant for a long time about how it was in his blood, it's something that was a part of him, so I just thought that was really sweet, and I guess, you know, when it came time for us to pick a name, I think it made a lot of sense.
Fantastic. That's really cool. Now, talk to us about how you guys came together. Was it like a coming together, or did you guys really have like an active plan and knew like how each member was going to fit in?
Tyler, who I was just talking about, and me have known each other forever, and he's played drums in a number of my bands before, and I've been writing a lot of my own songs and recording them and putting them up on the internet. And I knew the other two guys, Kevin and Thomas, from around West Palm Beach, where we all grew up. It's not a very big town, so we were kind of aware peripherally about each other's bands. And one night, I ended up hanging out with Thomas down in Miami at this party, and he was just very clear with me that he wanted to, you know, he was willing to play music with me. And he was very serious. He wanted to tour. He wanted to do it all. And, you know, he wanted to try and find a record label and stuff like that, stuff that had never really occurred to me. So after that, we just kind of never looked back. And it was, you know, and it's been awesome ever since then.
Now, you're the lead singer of the group. Can you tell us, like, what your writing process is? Like, do you guys all come together? Do you mainly handle it? Like, how does that all work?
Well, what we did for this most recent record, Pythons, that comes out in June, is we, I'll sit in my room for, you know, for maybe a week at a time, and I'll just make one demo after another with an acoustic guitar and a drum machine, and I'll write some, you know, a few lines here and there. And then I bring it to everybody else, and we sort of start fleshing it out in a rehearsal space and coming up with ideas to make it, you know, fun or dynamic or speed it up or slow it down. And it just seems to come kind of naturally to us.
Talk to us about Pythons. Is it like, you know, is there like a running theme or idea that you want your fans and new fans to take away from it? Or is it, you know, like a collection of songs?
It's a collection of songs. I like to think that there's a lot of cohesive elements sonically and lyrically to it. You know, there's a lot of imagery that repeats itself and a lot of sort of textures that are reoccurring. I don't know. I'd say it's a very moody record, a very dynamic record, you know, with everything from a really formulaic but catchy 3-minute pop song to like a longer, more sludgy psychedelic type song. So I think it pretty much covers all the bases.
Talk to us about your live show and your presence on stage. What do you guys like your fans to take away from your performances?
I want people to be moved. I also want them to laugh. I want them to feel like it was worth paying $20 or however much it costs to come to a concert these days, you know? I think it should be fun, and I think it should be interactive, and I think that they should really feel, you know, I like to feel a connection with the audience, and I hope that they feel a connection with me, too.
Do you think that your origin, coming from, you know, the southern east coast, if you will, from Florida, do you think that plays a big part in the sound of Surfer Blood?
I never really thought so before, but I could see how people could think that. We sort of gravitate towards a lot of classic sounds used by, you know, bands like the Beach Boys, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it does have sort of an anthemic sort of vibe to it. You know, all the songs are catchy. They're meant to be catchy. I can see how people can sort of put this fun in the sun sort of moniker to the band.
As an artist, who would you say has influenced you the most? Like, is there a band or a solo artist that you can point to and say, wow, like, they've really stuck in my head and my heart?
Oh, there's dozens. If I could think about my favorite songwriter, it would probably be Stephen Malkmus from Pavement and also from The Jicks. Mm-hmm. Is one of my biggest influences. Who else? The Strokes, growing up, were one of my favorite bands, who I listened to a lot of and probably influenced me more than I even know. The Smiths, I guess. I mean, bands like that. I like, you know, I go with the classic, timeless type of bands.
Is it important for Surfer Blood to have an active presence on social media?
I think it's important these days. Do we keep up with it as well as we should? Not really. You know, some people in our band are more internet savvy than others, and we could use a little help with that, I think, to be honest.
And where can we expect Surfer Blood to be going, you know, for the rest of 2013 and then as we march towards the new year?
When this record comes out, I'm sure we have a lot of shows to play. I mean, there's new stuff coming in every day that we're looking at, and it's exciting to be on the road right now playing new songs. So all I hope is that, you know, this continues for a while, because I enjoy traveling and I'm happy to be playing shows again, especially with all the new material we have. So yeah, the rest of the year should be pretty busy.
And is there like a TV show or even a specific festival or concert that, you know, you guys would love to be a part of?
We're open to ideas. I have a few favorites. There's a festival called Oya in Norway that we played a few years ago, and is one of the most serene experiences I've ever had. That was really fun. I don't know. We're pretty much open to anything, honestly. I just want to travel and experience things.
Awesome. JP, thank you so much for hanging out with us on the show today. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for having me.
That's JP from Surfer Blood on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, this is JP from Surfer Blood, and you're hanging out on The Kelly Alexander Show.
With Crazy Kids, the Will I Am remix on The Kelly Alexander Show. A big thank you going out to my guests this week, Lou Kay, Patrick Charles, Sharon Armstrong, as well as Surfer Blood. I also want to leave you with your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time from Henry Ford. You can't build a reputation on what you are going to do. So thank you so much for hanging out on the show. Please, please, please check us out on social media. Lots going on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/KellyAlexanderShow. Also on Twitter at KAlexanderShow. And more information, as always, on the website, KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.